As soon as he saw the gun, Bob Herbert threw his car into reverse and crushed the hand-controlled gas pedal down. The bullets from the van missed the driver's seat, pelting the hood and the front fender as the car rocketed away. Oncoming cars braked fast or swerved to avoid him. Herbert looked ahead and saw the front seat passenger of the van lean out the window. The man trained the gun on Herbert.
Sons of bitches, don't give up! Herbert yelled.
Slowed, because he had to do everything by hand, Herbert slammed the gas pedal and changed gears. Racing ahead, he quickly covered the 15 feet which separated him from the van. He rammed the van's left rear fender. The van was thrown forward and Herbert swung his Mercedes into the street. Still pressing hard on the gas, he raced past the driver's side and sped ahead. Then he remembered the cellular phone. He scooped it up.
Mike, are you still there? Christ, didn't you hear me shouting? Do you know where you are?
I've got no idea.
Can you see any signs?
No. Oh, wait, yes. Georgstrasse. I'm on Georgstrasse.
Hold on, we're bringing a map up on the computer.
Bob, you're okay there. Continue east if you can.
Shit!
Herbert cried again and dropped the phone. As the van got closer, Herbert looked in his rear-view mirror and saw the gunman reloading his weapon. He saw the gunman put his foot to the windshield and push it out. The man poked the gun out and sighted on the car. Herbert only had a moment to act. As the van neared, he smashed his hand on the brake. The Mercedes stopped suddenly, and the van rear-ended him hard. His trunk folded up. He saw the gunman tossed forward, thrown at the waist across the window frame. The gun flew from his hands. Herbert's only wound was another unpleasant scrape by the shoulder strap. He pressed down on the gas to get away. The car didn't move, but he could feel the tug of the two fenders locked together. Suddenly, the van bellowed back to life. Herbert felt a rough tug as the vehicles unhooked. Without stopping, the van continued to back up. It sped off, then turned a corner and vanished. In the distance, the intelligence officer heard the police siren, which had sent the neo-Nazis on their way. He thought of the police coming to question him. German police were not famed for their friendliness. At best, he would be treated objectively. At worst, he thought, the police station has a couple of neo-Nazi sympathizers. At worst, they put me in prison. At worst, somebody gets to me in the middle of the night with a knife or a length of steel wire. Screw that, he said. Herbert quickly shifted gears, picked up the phone, and set off after the van. As he walked back to the office building, Paul Hood was showered with memories of nearly 20 years ago. But as he entered the elevator in the lobby, he began to feel manipulated. Nancy had left, shown up a score of years later, and presented herself to him. Offered herself to him. Why? Not that it really mattered. He was back in the present. And maybe, he thought suddenly and surprisingly, you can stop blaming Sharon because she isn't Nancy. To complete his emotional buffet, Hood felt guilty for having left poor Housen standing there, his soul exposed, without the help of the man to whom he'd just confessed. Housen was standing beside Stoll in the main office. Lang was still at Stoll's right. Housen met Hood with concerned eyes.
Did you get what you needed?
Pretty much. Hood smiled reassuringly. Housen managed to smile as well.
I'm glad we spoke.
Stoll was busy typing in commands. What have you found out? Hood asked him.
Well, as I was just telling Herz, Housen, and Lang, the game was installed with a time release command by the deputy foreign minister's assistant.
The computer screen brought up the photo downloaded from OpCenter's Geolog program. Hood leaned forward and read the caption. The Tarn at Montauban-le-Vieux-Pont. The building is a stronghold built in 1144 and has historically been associated with regionalism in the south of France.
Well, does it say anything about who owns the place? I'm a-checkin', said Stoll. Here, a privately held French company named Demain, which was incorporated in the city of Toulouse in May 1979.
Hood said, get me more information on that company. Quickly. Stoll nodded, cleared the screen, and rang up OpCenter. They sent over a short article from a magazine called Video Gaming Illustrated. It read, Games of Tomorrow. Even if you still love yesterday's hits, a new star in the video game firmament, the French company Demain, which means tomorrow, has developed a different kind of cartridge to play on your home systems. A Night to Remember will be in stores this month. In a press release, company research and development head Jean-Michel Horn says, "Thanks to a revolutionary and powerful new chip we have developed, graphics and gameplay will be more detailed and exciting." Hood took a moment to contemplate the article and weigh the implications. It helped to put together some pieces. Nancy stole plans for a new chip and sold them to a company, possibly, no, probably, this Demain. Gerard, a racist, makes a fortune manufacturing video games. On the sly, he puts money into hate games. Charlie Squires' kid surfed into one. What if that were Dominique's? Could Gerard be using the internet to send them around the world? Assume yes. Why do that? Not just to make money. From what Hausen said, Dominique had enough of that. He would have to have something bigger in mind. Hate games appearing on the internet. Confident threats to Hausen. Were they timed to coincide with chaos days? It all seemed to be going nowhere. Too many pieces were missing. And there was one person who might be able, but willing, to tell him what that could be. "Herr Hausen," Hood said, "would you mind if I borrowed your driver for a short while?" "Not at all." "Bob," said the caller, "I've got good news." He told his assistant, Alberta, to have the National Reconnaissance Office try to find the van for him. When they did, Herbert intended to go to the site, ascertain that this was the van, and these were the people who had attacked him, and call the police. Alberta said, "You're in luck. The NRO is already watching your area for Larry Racklin, who's looking into the kidnapping of the film intern." Larry was director of the CIA. "What's the NRO got?" "Stephen Viens found the van. It's a definite match, banged up just where you said it'd be. It's headed west on one of the Autobahnen, though from just the photo I can't tell you which one." "That's okay, I'll find it on the map. I know it's a waste of breath to try and talk you out of it." "You got that right, son. So I'll just tell General R. what you're doing. Is there anything else you need?" "Yes. If the van gets off the Autobahn, give me a jingle."
"Of course," said Alberto.
"Stephen said he'll have his people keep an eye on it." Stephen Viens was the director of the NRO with 100 satellites under his command. He could provide detailed black-and-white photographs of the Earth at whatever magnification was required. Viens was fond of saying, "I can give you a picture covering several city blocks or the letters on a children's block." The phone beeped. "Bob, it's Alberto. I just got a new photograph, a 2MD of the entire region." A 2MD was a 2-mile diameter view with a van at the center. "Where?" Herbert said. "Give me a landmark." "Police. About a dozen of them surrounding what's left of a blown-out vehicle. They tell me this could be the movie trailer. They think the fire started on the right rear at what looks like the gas tank." "Hold on, Bob," Alberto said excitedly. "We just got a quarter-mile view to the east of the wreck. There's part of a rough dirt road and what could be a person in one of the trees." "Where's the white van now?" Herbert asked. "It was in the picture with the trailer. None of the police are looking over." That'd be a kick in the head, thought Herbert. The local police in cahoots with the local neo-Nazi militia. He said, "Is there any way to get to that tree without being seen by the police?" "Yes. You can exit, pull to the right off the road, and take that dirt road." "I can't. If the kidnappers headed into the woods instead of out, I don't want to run into them." "All right. Then you can circumvent them by going, southeast. Roughly 1/3 of a mile to a stream, cross to the east to about 1/4 of a mile. Shit, there's no landmark there." "I'll find it, boss. I'll find it. What's next?" "Then you go northeast about 75 yards to a gnarly old, whatever it is. Marcia says it's an oak, but that's pretty rough terrain for a man in a wheelchair." "I'll be fine. You take a paycheck. You got to do the shit work. Listen, we can't call the police because we don't know if some of them are in with these guerrillas. We don't have any options." "I'm still against this, but good luck, boss." The stretch limousine arrived at Jean-Michel Horn's Hamburg Hotel promptly at 5:30 p.m. Jean-Michel had not been sure that Richter wouldn't arrive with a truck filled with militiamen to exact vengeance for the fire that Dominique's two bodyguards, Yves and Henri, had set. But that wasn't Richter's style. After the limousine stopped and the doorman opened the door, Yves and Henri climbed in with Jean-Michel between them. Jean-Michel was not surprised to find Richter considerably more subdued than before. Herr Richter, it was not Monsieur Dominique's wish for things to escalate as they did.
Is that an apology? The German asked.
Jean-Michel shook his head.
Consider it an olive branch?
I spit on it, and you.
The German reached into his jacket pocket, and both Henri and Yves started forward. Richter ignored them. He withdrew a cigarette case, put a cigarette in his mouth, and replaced the case. He withdrew his hand. And before Jean-Michel saw that he was not holding a cigarette lighter, it was too late. The compact baby Browning pistol spit twice, once to the left of Jean-Michel, once to the right.
I'll have them buried in the woods when we arrive.
Still holding the gun, the German leaned forward. He removed the pistols in Yves and Henri's shoulder holsters and placed the guns on the seat to his right. He patted Jean-Michel's chest and pockets to make sure he had no weapons, then sat back. Jean-Michel was confused and very frightened.
This afternoon was quite an epiphany, Monsieur Horn. 2 hours ago, Karen Doring and I agreed to merge Feuer and the 21st Century National Socialists. We will announce the union in Hanover tonight. Our party will be known as Das National Feuer, the National Fire. Karen and I will be meeting at her camp. We'll lead her people to Hanover, and there, with my followers, as well as the thousands or so believers who are already present, nearly 3,000 of us will create an impromptu march, the likes of which Germany hasn't seen for years. And the authorities will do nothing to stop us.
As Jean-Michel listened, he was struck with a numbing realization of what he had wrought, how he had let Monsieur Dominique down.
Herr Richter, Monsieur Dominique has plans of his own. He can certainly fight you.
I expect him to try. But he won't take Germany from me.
Richter took a long breath, then said, barely above a whisper,
in just a few years, this country will be mine. Mine to restore, just as Hitler built the Reich on the wreckage of the Weimar Republic. And the irony is that you, Monsieur Horn, were the architect. You showed me that I was facing an enemy I didn't anticipate. Tonight you will see why I am confident that Felix Richter, and not Gerard Dominique, will be the next Führer of Europe.
Hood was barely aware of being driven through the crowded streets of Hamburg. When the car pulled up in front of the Ambassador Hotel, Hood bolted out and ran to the house telephones.
Paul, is that you?
Nancy sounded genuinely surprised and pleased. Yes, Nancy, I'm in the lobby. Can we talk?
Of course, come up.
Nancy answered the door wearing tight jeans and a pink polo shirt. She smiled her perfect smile, then turned and walked back to the bed. There was an open suitcase on the cover. As she packed the last of her toiletries, Hood walked over.
I thought when we said goodbye, that was it.
So what is it, Paul? Why did you come? Truthfully, to ask you a couple of questions about your work. Nancy stared at him.
Are you serious?
He nodded. Have you ever heard of a man named Gerard Dominique? Nancy stiffened. We think that Gerard Dominique may be behind the hate video games which have begun showing up in America. A game like that just showed up on Hausen's computer with Hausen in it. Earlier today, Dominique phoned and threatened Hausen. The question is, can you help me? Do you work for this man? Nancy turned away.
You think that because I betrayed an employer years ago, I'll do it again?
This isn't the same thing, is it? Hood asked. Nancy took a deep breath, stood tall, and looked into his eyes.
Yes, I work for Gerard Dominique. But I'm not privy to his politics or personal life, so I don't think I can help you there.
What are you working on?
Maps of American cities.
You mean like regular road maps? She shook her head.
They're what we call point of view maps.
A traveler inputs the street coordinates, and the computer shows you how to get around the city.
Have you seen any marketing plans?
No, but that doesn't surprise me. That's not my area. The one thing which did surprise me is that we haven't done any press releases on these programs.
Is Demain working on any kind of new technology? Something that ordinary video gamers would find compelling?
Constantly. But the one we're closest to marketing is a silicon chip which stimulates nerve cells. When it's placed inside a joystick, the chip generates gentle pulses to make a player feel a kind of subtle contentment, or harsher pulses to suggest danger. I've tried it. It's all pretty subliminal, like nicotine.
Hood was feeling slightly overwhelmed. A feel-good, feel-bad chip, marketed by a bigot. Hate games, online in the U.S.
Could the two of them be combined, he asked? Hate games and a chip that affects the emotions?
Nancy shrugged.
Why not?
Did you ever do anything with images from Toulouse?
Sure. We used our delicious little factory fortress as a background for some kind of promotional download.
Did you ever see the finished product?
Nancy shook her head.
I think I did, Hood said. It was in the game in Hausen's computer.
Nancy, one more thing. Is it possible that those maps you created could be used in games?
Of course.
With figures superimposed?
Yes. You could integrate photographs or computer-generated images, just like motion pictures.
Hood was beginning to get a picture he didn't like. He walked slowly toward the phone.
I'm going to call my office, he said. There's something happening that I'm starting to get real worried about. Actually, he continued as he punched in Mike Rogers' number, the world, or a good part of it, may be hanging in the balance. And you may be the only one who can save it.
Physically, this had been the most demanding, frustrating, and rewarding hour of Bob Herbert's life. The terrain he'd had to cross was covered with sticks, rotting leaves and tree trunks, rocks and thick patches of mud. There was one small stream, less than a foot deep, which slowed him further. At several minutes past six, it had begun to get dark. Though his chair was equipped with a powerful flashlight beside each footrest, Herbert was unable to see farther ahead than the diameter of each wheel. That slowed him further. And he hurt, from the twigs that stuck him, and the muscles that pained him, and the chest that still hurt from where the seatbelt had pulled during the chase through Hanover. Herbert picked his way through the woods, guided by the 30-year-old Boy Scout pocket compass which had been around the world with him. While he made his way, he tried to make sense of the neo-Nazis' trip out here. They couldn't have radioed a police ally for assistance, since other officers would have heard. Yet somehow the police were here and seemed to be helping them. Perhaps they needed someone to find them. The neo-Nazis had fled at the siren, so they obviously feared he might be able to ID them. A police ally could find out who he was and where he was staying. Herbert shook his head. After a few minutes more, he arrived at the tree where Alberto thought the girl might be. Reaching down, Herbert removed the flashlight from the footrest. He shined it into the tree.
Jody, are you up there?
He felt a little foolish calling up a tree for a young woman. He heard nothing.
Jody, my name is Bob Herbert. I'm an American. If you're up there, please come down. I want to help you.
Herbert waited. Again, there was no sound.
Mein Herr, said a deep, masculine voice. Please raise your hands.
Herbert obeyed. Herbert could see that the man was a police officer, but he wasn't dressed like any of the officers at the van. This man was wearing what looked like a police-issue blue overcoat and a cap. And then it hit him. The siren, the sudden termination of the chase, the drive out here, the whole thing had been a setup. The police officer stopped a few feet away, too far to reach even if Herbert could snatch his stick from under the armrest. Through the open front of the policeman's coat, Bob Herbert saw a cellular phone hooked to a black leather belt. The intelligence chief just looked up at him and said,
They called you from the van when they were still in the city, didn't they? They pretended to run from your siren, knew I'd follow them, and then you followed me.
The officer did not appear to understand. Not that it mattered. Herbert was disgusted with himself. He was glad, at least, that that hadn't been Jody the satellite saw in the tree. If she'd been there, she'd be seconds from death along with him. He'd gotten sloppy, and this was the price.
I wonder if I'll hear the crack of the gun before the bullet hits, he thought.
Auf Wiedersehen, the German said to him.
Located on one of the shopping streets in old Toulouse, in a third-floor room of a dilapidated old store he had rented, Colonel Bernard Ballon of the Gendarmerie Nationale was watching the live pictures being broadcast from outside the Demain factory to four TV monitors. The plant was located some 30 kilometers north of the city center. Ballon's men had placed hidden cameras at all four sides of the ancient edifice in the ancient town of Montauban. They videotaped every truck and employee that entered or left. All they needed to see was one known member of the new Jacobins. Once one of the terrorists had been spotted, Ballon and his elite tactical squad would be inside within 20 minutes. The cars were parked nearby. The men were sitting around audio equipment and other video monitors, and the weapons were in duffel bags in the corner. The search warrants, too, were in order. After 17 years of tracking, arresting, and trying to break members of the new Jacobin terrorist organization, after 17 years of watching his own interest become an obsession, Ballon was certain that Dominique was ready to make something happen. And not just the heralded launch of his new video games. He had launched new games before, and they had never required this level of manpower. Dominique was staying at the factory more and more at night instead of going home. Employees were working longer shifts. It had been extremely difficult for Ballon to convince his superiors to let him undertake this month-long stakeout. The Gendarmerie Nationale were very much aware of the legal forces and deadly publicity Dominique could muster against them.
And for what? His commander had asked him. Because you suspect him of a crime that is two decades old? We can't even prosecute him.
That was true. Too much time had passed. Upon investigating the crime scene that night, Ballon had learned that wealthy Gérard Dupré had been seen in the area with another man, and the police hadn't wished to pursue them. Hadn't wished to pursue Dupré. As a result, he had quite possibly gotten away with murder. Ballon had resigned from the police force in utter disgust. Then he joined the gendarmerie and studied the Dupré family. He learned from sealed files in the government archives how the elder Dupré had been a collaborator during World War II. How he'd infiltrated the resistance and informed on many of its members. At least 30 deaths were attributed to that bâtard. After the war, Dupré found a successful business manufacturing spare parts for the Airbus. The young Dupré had changed his name to Dominique, and when the new Jacobins began terrorizing foreigners, Ballon had little doubt that they were Dominique's soldiers. But the gendarmerie had refused to launch an official investigation into Dominique. Ballon pushed his strong fingers along his cheek. He savored that sandpaper roughness of his face as the telephone rang. One of the young officers answered the phone.
Sir, it's another call being routed from America.
Ballon screamed. I told them before not to put anyone through. It's either a bloody opportunist trying to ride our efforts across the finish line or a saboteur trying to hold us back. Now they want to help me. Now!
Ballon muttered.
Where have they been for 17 years?
Sergeant Saint-Marie said warily,
Perhaps this is not what you think.
Ballon walked briskly toward the phone. He wouldn't know the answer unless he took the call.
This is Ballon. What is it?
Colonel, said the dispatcher, I have a phone call from General Michael Rogers of the National Crisis Management.
Colonel Ballon, Rogers cut in, forgive the interruption, but I need to talk to you.
Do you speak English?
I speak English, Ballon said reluctantly.
I understand you're trying to close in on a mutual enemy.
Trying, yes.
We believe, Rogers said, that he's planning to download computer software which will help to cause rioting in cities around the world. We believe he intends to use those riots to throw the economies of major American and European nations into chaos.
Ballon's mouth began to go dry. This man was either a godsend or the pawn of Satan himself.
How about his terrorist squads? What do you know about those? He asked, hoping for some new information.
Nothing, Rogers admitted. But we suspect he's working closely with several neo-Nazi groups in America and abroad.
Ballon was silent for a moment. He still didn't trust this man entirely.
Your information is interesting, but not very useful. I need evidence.
I need to find out what's going on inside his fortress.
Rogers said eagerly, well, if that's the problem, I can help. I was calling Colonel Ballon to offer you the assistance of a NATO commander in Italy. His name is Colonel Brett August, and his specialty is...
I have read white papers by Colonel August, said Ballon. He is a brilliant counter-terrorist operative.
I also have equipment in Germany which I'll lend to you.
What kind of equipment?
It's a new kind of X-ray device, one with which my operator can probably work some near miracles.
A new kind of X-ray? Ballon said dubiously. That isn't going to help. I don't need to know where people are.
It might be able to read papers for you, Rogers said, or lips.
General Michael Rogers, how do I know you are not working with Dominique?
Because we also know about a pair of murders he committed 20 years ago. We know about them because we know the person who was with him at the time. I can tell you nothing more except that I want Dominique brought to justice.
All right, said the colonel. How do I get in touch with this miracle worker of yours?
Stay where you are. I'll have him phone you there.
Paul Hood arrived at Hausen's office with Nancy. Hausen was talking on a cellular phone in the reception area. Lang was sitting on the edge of the desk. Matt Stoll was still sitting at Hausen's computer in the main office. Lang walked over to them. Hood introduced him. This is Nancy Jo Bosworth. She's an employee of Demain.
I see, Lang said with a polite smile.
I'm not a friend of Dominique's, she added. I don't know him.
It appears that few do, Lang said, still smiling.
Hood excused himself to introduce Nancy to Stoll, then stood beside her as she watched Stoll guide fluidly animated dogs running through a swamp. Nancy said, I take it this is the game Herr Hausen received?
Yep,
Stoll said. Almost immediately, one of the dogs he was controlling fell into quicksand and began sinking.
Shit,
he yelled. Deal with it, Nancy said. She leaned over him and pushed the down arrow on the keyboard.
Hey, what are you doing? Stoll demanded.
You missed something.
As she held the button down, the dog drifted through the quicksand and emerged in an underground cavern.
How did you know that was there? Hood asked.
This is an adaptation of a game I designed, called The Bog Beast. Same game screens, background, foreground elements, traps. Different characters and scenario, though. I had a swamp monster running from its creator and angry villagers.
Paul, I know I screwed up in the past, but this isn't my doing. Any number of people could have made these changes.
I believe you, Hood said. His cellular phone beeped, and he excused himself.
Paul, said the caller, it's Daryl. I've met with Liz and Mike, and it looks to us like this fellow you were asking about is Mr. Haight himself, and powerful enough to avoid arrest.
Explain.
He appears to use a network of banks to launder money and finance hate groups worldwide. Meanwhile, it looks like he's getting set to introduce a new joystick, which helps players feel as if whatever they're seeing on the screen is very real. But our immediate problem isn't any of that. The Pure Nation team that got picked up this morning may have been a plant. It looks like they and the hate games could be part of a larger plan to turn U.S. cities into racial war zones.
Does it look like there's any kind of timetable?
Tough to say. The media are all over Pure Nation, and we think they're going to milk that for them. The games are also ready to launch. If this is a coordinated effort, the coordinator isn't going to let the fear grow cold. A couple of strikes against blacks and communities won't just ignite, they'll explode. We agree that in a worst-case scenario, incidents could begin erupting within days, if not hours.
You think that all of this is being generated by one man?
McCaskey said, that's how it looks from here.
So if we were to get to the one man, Hood said, we could put the brakes on everything.
Conceivably.
Let's work on that. Meanwhile, has anybody heard anything from Bob?
McCaskey said, actually, yes.
Hood didn't like the way that sounded.
What's he doing?
McCaskey explained, and Hood listened, feeling guilty as all hell for having let Herbert go off on his own.
Paul, McCaskey said, hold on a moment. I've got a priority call coming in.
McCaskey was back. Mike's on the line as well. We may have a situation. I just heard from my contact at the FBI. They've been notified about 5 white-on-black killings at the same time in 5 different cities. New York, Los Angeles, New Orleans, Baltimore, and Atlanta. In each case, 2 to 4 young white males ambushed a black rap singer. In Atlanta, they got Sweet T, the number one female rapper, as she was leaving her apartment. Rogers came on the line and said somberly, "Do you realize what we've just had here? Those attacks were a modern-day Kristallnacht." The attacks were similar, Hood thought, yet there was something different. "No," Hood said suddenly with alarm, "this was not another Crystal Night. It was only a prelude." "How so?" Rogers asked. "Neo-Nazis killed rappers. That'll enrage the so-called gangsters and their hardcore audience. They turn on whites, many of whom don't approve of rap to begin with, and you end up with more racial incidents, riots, and American cities on fire. That's when the neo-Nazis return. When white America is tired of rioters. When the media shows black radicals demanding white blood. That's when the new Crystal Night, the coordinated armed attack, begins."
"But how do the neo-Nazis benefit?" Rogers asked. "They can't break the law and then run for office."
"The prettified ones can," said Hood. "The ones who distance themselves from the lawbreakers, but not from the intolerance which motivates them." The plan made sense, and the more Hood thought about it, the more brilliant it seemed in its simplicity. Less than 55 years after Hitler's death, the monsters could actually become a political force in the U.S. He said, "It's a nightmare."
"Paul, we can still stop this thing. If we can expose Dominique's operation to the people, they'll see how they were manipulated."
"Mike, if you can tell me how to get to him, I'll be happy to do it." Rogers related his conversation with the colonel and concluded,
"From my talk with Ballon, he sounds like the kind of guy who'd love to see Dominique accidentally on purpose fall down a flight of concrete steps."
"Say no more." Hood glanced over at Matt Stoll's innocent-looking backpack. "How do I contact Colonel Ballon?" Paul wrote down the telephone number, then hung up. Hood said to his group, "There's a Gendarmerie Nationale officer who is in Toulouse and is eager to hand Monsieur Dominique his head." He looked at Nancy. "Sorry, but that's how it is." Her mouth scrunched unhappily.
"I understand."
Paul didn't look at Nancy as he placed the call to Ballon. The crack Bob Herbert heard was not the report of the gun. The sound had come from above. The branch fell heavily through the trees. Though the police officer hopped aside, he couldn't avoid the young woman who dropped from the tree a moment later. She crashed down on him, spilling them both to the ground. He had managed to hold on to the gun, but she rose, stepped on his wrist, and wrested it away. "Here," she said, pushing the weapon into Herbert's hands. He aimed it at the police officer's head. When the man didn't stir, Herbert looked at the young woman. "Jody Thompson?" She nodded. She was gasping.
"My name's Herbert. Bob Herbert. I work for the U.S. government. I want to thank you for what you did."
She said in breathless chunks,
"It's not the first time I've fallen for a guy."
He smiled.
"I fell asleep up there. I woke when I heard you and saw what he was going to do."
Jody screamed,
"Look out!"
Herbert had made the mistake of looking at the girl. The German had pushed off from the ground. He dove for the gun. The wheelchair spilled over backward with the two men on it, and four hands scrapped for the weapon. Herbert lost the gun in the struggle and decided not to try and find it. Lying on his back with a police officer on top of him, he reached under the right armrest and slipped the Urban Skinner from its sheath. He drove the knife up hard into the soft flesh under the officer's chin. He cut to the heart side, slicing both the internal and external jugular veins. The German glared down with pain and shock as the soil beneath them turned muddy with blood. When the German finally fell still, Herbert pushed him off. He cleaned his knife on the police officer's coat and slipped it back in its sheath.
"Are you all right, Jody?"
She nodded briskly.
"If you help me back into my chair, we can get out of here."
As she struggled to help him up, she said,
"Mr. Herbert."
"Bob."
"Bob,"
Jody said.
"What do you know about the people who tried to kill me?"
"I believe they're at a lake north of here."
"How far north?"
"A few miles."
Herbert picked up his phone.
I'm going to let my superiors know I found you, get you to Hamburg, and fly you home. I don't want to go yet. I was thinking how much I hate them. And I was thinking that maybe I survived for a reason.
You did, Herbert said, to go home to your folks.
If that's true, then I'll get home to them, only a little later. I want to do something about what's going on here.
Good. When you get back to the States, sell the movie rights to your story. I'm serious. Let people know what's happening in the real world. Just make sure Tom Selleck plays me, okay? And that you hold on to creative control.
I studied film, Jody said, and right now we haven't got a climax.
Herbert made a face. Bull, he said, and spread his fingers headline size. Long Island girl helps government agent kill German neo-Nazi police officer.
A better one would be, American girl makes grandfather proud by fighting his old enemies. More substance, less sensation.
As we used to say in Beirut, you're gutsy but nutsy.
Jody walked over to the police officer and picked up his gun.
We were using a P-38 like this in the movie. The prop man showed me how to use it. I hit a log from 10 yards away.
Herbert finished inputting the telephone number. Jody pressed her lips together, leaned over, and touched the disconnect button.
Thanks for your help, Bob, but I'm going.
No, you're not. What'll you do if you get there? Kill Karen?
No. I don't want to be like her. I just want her to see that I'm alive and unafraid. She left me without anything in the trailer. No hope, no pride, zero. I've got to get that back.
But you have.
What you're seeing now, this isn't pride, it's shame. The fear of shame. The fear that I'm too afraid to face her. I need to bite the ear of my torturer.
Herbert was totally confused.
Excuse me?
It's something my grandfather once did. If I don't do that, I'll never be able to walk into a dark room or down a lonely street without being afraid.
You'll have about 10 seconds of glory before they cut you down.
Not if you help me.
And how am I supposed to live with myself if anything happens to you? Besides, you don't have anything to prove.
Jody's mouth twisted. She rose and started walking away.
Bullshit. Bullshit! Jody, quiet down. Herbert hissed. Come back.
She shook her head and kept walking. Swearing, Herbert started after her. He stopped, listened, swore again. Someone was coming. There were two sets of footsteps. They stopped moving just about where the body would be. After a moment, the footsteps continued in their direction. Herbert slid his stick from beneath the armrest and waited. Jody's footsteps retreated to the right. Two men walked past. He recognized their blue-gray windbreakers. They were both men from the van. Herbert waited until they walked by. Then he quickly wheeled behind the second man, swung his stick sideways, and clubbed him hard in the thigh. The man doubled over. When his friend turned around, his submachine gun at his side, Herbert brought the stick swinging back into his left kneecap. The man dropped face forward toward Herbert. Herbert struck him hard on the head. As the first man groaned and struggled to get back to his feet, Herbert hit him on the back of the neck. He flopped down. As he had been trained from his earliest days in intelligence work, Herbert took stock of the things he knew for certain. First, in this situation, he could only rely on himself. Second, if Jody reached the camp before him, she would be killed. And third, she was probably going to reach the camp before him. Picking up the compact submachine gun, a Czech Scorpion, he set it in his lap and wheeled after her. As Colonel Ballon sat watching the video monitor, he thought, like most Frenchmen, how little he cared for Americans. Even in France, they expected everyone to speak English. Then there was the military. They assumed that members of the French armed forces were inferior to American soldiers. The only good thing about Americans was that they gave him someone other than Germans to hate. His phone beeped. Ballon didn't really want to talk to this Mr. Hood, but he didn't want to let Dominique get away even more. He snatched up the phone.
Oui?
Colonel Ballon.
Oui?
The caller said, without missing a beat,
Je suis Paul Hood. Vous avez besoin d'assistance?
Ballon was caught off guard.
Hey, vous parlez la langue?
Je parle un peu,
Hood said. He spoke a little French. Then we'll speak English, replied Ballon. I don't want to hear you murder my language. Mr. Hood, I want Dominique. I've been told you have equipment which will help me get him. Where are you?
Hamburg.
Very good. If you hurry, you can be here in about 2 hours.
We'll be there, said Hood.
Ballon felt his passion leak away. Who else is there?
Deputy Foreign Minister Richard Hausen and the two other persons in my party.
It had to be a German, he thought. God does not love me.
Ballon glowered. He did not want an attention-hungry German government official in on his operation, and said as much to Paul Hood.
I take a different view of him, Hood said calmly.
Ballon said quickly,
I need you. You want him, so that is that. I will meet you at the Aerodrome de la Borde at 8 o'clock.
Martin Lang was on his cellular phone as Hood helped Matt Stoll gather together his equipment. Lang was phoning the airport outside of Hamburg, ordering the corporate jet to be readied.
Done, said Lang, hanging up. The plane will be waiting at 7:30. I won't be joining you. I'd only be in the way.
I understand, Hausen said. The rest of us had better be going. After more than an hour of pushing himself, Bob Herbert saw headlights about an eighth of a mile to the southwest. The vehicle was moving slowly along the rough road Alberto had told him about, and he waited as it passed. The brake lights flashed in the distance. The interior lights went on, and dark figures moved away from him. Herbert moved over the lumpy ground toward the car, a limousine. As he reached the car, he tucked the Scorpion under his leg. He could see the tops of tents. He saw young men standing between the tents, looking toward campfires beyond them. And then he saw at least 300 people facing a clear spot by the lake, where a man and woman stood alone. The man was speaking. Herbert listened, able to understand most of the German.
From tonight forward, our two groups will work together, united by a common goal and a single name, Das Nationalfeuer.
The crowd cheered. When the cheering died, he heard a voice whisper behind him.
I waited for you.
Jody, let's go back, please. This is insane.
Herbert's voice was drowned out as the speaker continued.
The woman beside me, my co-leader, Karen Döring.
Applause rolled from the mob spontaneously.
Karen has sent emissaries to Hanover. In just a few minutes, we will all go to the city, to the beer hall, to announce our new union to the world.
The applause grew to a torrent, and Herbert used the cover of the din to yell at Jody.
Come on, he said, pulling at her hand. These people will fall on you like dingoes.
Jody stared out at the rally.
I don't want to die, but I don't want to live pathetically.
Jody, you won't.
She wrenched her hand from Herbert. He wheeled after her, cursing. As the applause died, Jody's footsteps seemed quite loud to Herbert, also apparently to the sentry nearest them, who turned. He saw them in the light of the fires and shouted to the young men and women who were standing nearest to him. A moment later, the sentry was moving forward and the others were forming a line behind him.
There was never any question that I would know how to fly.
Paul Hood stood behind Richard Hausen as he piloted the Learjet through the skies over France. Martin Lang's full-time pilot sat beside him. Hood listened while the eager, almost buoyant Hausen told him about his youth. Hausen's father, Maximilian, had been a pilot with the Luftwaffe. He'd specialized in night fighting. Like many Germans, Hausen did not speak apologetically of his father's wartime exploits. Military service could not be avoided, and it didn't diminish Hausen's love or respect for Maximilian.
When I was 7, my father taught me to fly. I always saw beauty from the air turned to squalor on the ground. When I came of age, I decided to help people.
Your parents must have been proud, Hood said. Hausen's expression darkened.
Not exactly. It was a very complicated situation. My father had quite definite ideas about things, and I turned my back on my father's wishes.
I see. And are they still furious?
My father passed away 2 years ago. We were able to talk shortly before his death,
though much too much was left unsaid. My mother and I speak regularly. While he listened, Hood couldn't help but think back to Ballon's comments about Hausen being a headline grabber. Having been a politician himself, Hood understood that good press was important, but he wanted to believe that this man was sincere. And in any case, there wasn't going to be press coverage in France. As Hood was about to return to the cabin, Stoll yelled,
"Come here, Chief. Something's happening on the computer."
"What's wrong?"
"Look what just hacked its way into the game I was playing."
Hood stood beside him on the right. Nancy moved from her seat on the other side of the cabin and sat on Stoll's left. They all looked at the screen. There was a graphic of a vellum-like scroll with Gothic-style printing. "Citizens, hear ye," it read. "We pray you will forgive this interruption. Did you know that according to the Sentencing Project, a public interest group, one-third of all black men between the ages of 20 and 29 are in prison, on probation, or on parole? Did you know that this figure marks a 10% rise from just 5 years ago? Did you know that these blacks cost the nation over $6 billion each year? Watch for us in 83 minutes. Hood asked, "Where did this come from, Matt?"
"I have no idea. Sophisticated break-ins like this are usually done through a series of computers."
"So you can't just follow the trail backward?" Hood asked. Stoll shook his head. "Is this appearing anywhere else?" Stoll's fingers were already speeding over the keyboard.
"Checking,"
he said as he typed. After a moment, the screen changed.
"It's safe to say the interlopers only went after the gamers."
"Which makes sense," Nancy said, "if they're going to be offering hate games to that market." She looked at Hood. "You obviously think this is Dominique's doing."
"He has the capability, doesn't he?"
"That doesn't make him a criminal."
Stoll said, "There are touches on this scroll which remind me of the game in Hausen's office. A lot of the same artistic graphic touches."
Stoll erased the program on his laptop.
"Give me the names of some of those high-ups who have the technical chops to process game programs."
Nancy said, "The entire process?"
"Only two of them can do that. Etienne Escarbot and Jean-Michel Horn."
Stoll input the names, sent them off to Op Center, and asked for a background report. While they waited, Hood addressed something that had been roiling around inside him since he'd spoken with Ballon. The colonel had been less than enthused about Hausen's participation. He'd called him a headline grabber.
"What if he were worse than that?"
Hood wondered. "What if Hausen and Dominique weren't enemies?" Hood only had Hausen's account of what had transpired in Paris 20-odd years ago. What if the two were working together? Christ, Ballon said that Dominique's father had made his fortune in Airbus construction. Airplanes. And Hausen was a goddamn pilot. Hood carried his thinking a few steps further. What if Reiner had been doing exactly what his boss wanted, making Hausen look like a victim of a hate game in order to sucker Op Center, Ballon, and the German government into an embarrassing incursion? Who would ever attack Dominique a second time if the first assault turned up nothing?
Stoll said, "Aha! In 1981, Monsieur Escarbot was charged by a Parisian firm with stealing trade secrets from IBM. And criminal charges were filed and then dropped 21 years ago against Monsieur Horn. Seems he received a French patent for an advanced chip, which an American company said was stolen from them. Only they couldn't prove it. They also couldn't find the person who supposedly ripped off the..."
Stoll stopped reading. His white face turned slowly toward Hood, then toward Nancy.
"That was me," she said.
"It's okay," Hood said to him. "I knew all about it." Stoll nodded slowly. He regarded Nancy.
"Forgive me, but as a software designer myself, I just have to say, that's very uncool."
"I know," Nancy replied.
"That's enough, Matt," Hood said sternly. Matt sat back and looked out the window.
And then Hood thought, damn everything. Here he was, rebuking Stoll, when what he should have been doing was wondering about Nancy showing up in the park the way she did. And when he happened to be with Richard Hausen, was it a coincidence, or were they all in this thing with Dominique? He suddenly felt very unsure and very stupid. In the rush of events, Hood had utterly ignored security and caution.
What's more, he'd allowed his group to be split. His security expert, Bob Herbert, was roaming around the German countryside. It could be that he was making more of this than there was. His gut told him he was, but his brain told him to try and find out before they got to Demain, if possible. Hood remained beside Stoll while Nancy had returned to her side of the aircraft. Hood borrowed the laptop from Stoll and asked him quietly to patch him into Op Center. Hood typed his personal transmission code in quickly, then wrote, "Daryl, I need every detail you can get on the life of German Deputy Foreign Minister Richard Hausen. Also, details of post-war life and activities of Maximilian Hausen of the Luftwaffe. Call me when you have anything." Hood handed Stoll the computer. Then he walked over to Nancy and buckled himself in beside her. "I'm sorry I got you into this," he said.
"It's all right. Really it is, Paul. A big part of me is tired of running and of depending on Demain. What was it that Sidney Carton said on the way to the scaffold in A Tale of Two Cities? It is a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done. This is far, far better than the things I've done till now."
Hood smiled warmly. He wanted to tell her not to worry about the scaffold, but he couldn't guarantee her fate any more than he could swear to her allegiance. Hood's wireless transmission was received by Daryl McCaskey, who alerted Mike Rogers. Rogers felt that if Paul Hood had doubts about the Hausen clan, there must really be cause for concern.
"He's going into France to search for a terrorist group with only Matt Stoll as backup," the general said to his empty office. He wished he already had a regional op center, fully staffed and with Stryker personnel on hand. Instead, he typed in "Map Euro." A full-color map of Europe appeared. He overlaid a grid and studied it for a moment.
540 miles from northern Italy to the south of France," he muttered. Rogers hit the escape key and typed "NATO Italy." Within 5 seconds, a menu was on screen, offering troop and armament selections. He moved down the list and stopped. The V-22 Osprey, a Bell and Boeing vertical takeoff and landing vehicle, cruising speed 345 miles an hour. The prototype had been turned over to the 6th Fleet for testing in Naples. Rogers smiled. Within 3 minutes, Rogers had pulled General Vincenzo Di Fate, senior NATO military commander in Europe, away from a dinner party, and was explaining why he needed to borrow the chopper and 10 French soldiers, and one Colonel August Brett. Jody was standing directly between Herbert and the sentry. The boy asked something in German. Jody said she didn't understand. He shouted to someone behind him. As he did, he stepped slightly to the left. Herbert aimed the Scorpion at the boy's right shin and fired. The brawny young man went down with a shriek. The crowd fell silent, and the line of neo-Nazis hit the dirt well behind the wounded man. As Herbert rounded the car, he yelled to Jody, "Do your thing, and then let's go!" The girl looked at him, then looked across the field of white faces.
"You didn't beat me," she yelled in a strong voice, "and you won't."
Herbert opened the passenger's side.
"Jody!"
The girl ran back.
"Get in the driver's side,"
Herbert told her as he started to pull himself in.
"The keys are still in the ignition."
One of the neo-Nazis in the line had gotten up. She was holding a gun. She aimed at Jody.
"Shit!"
Herbert said and fired through the window. Jody screamed and the German was thrown backward behind a splash of blood. Herbert got back out of the car and into his wheelchair and covered her retreat from behind the open door. Jody got into the car, started the engine, and gunned it. The young woman was no longer composed. Herbert couldn't afford to lose her. She began to cry.
"Jody!"
"What?" she screamed.
"I want you to back the car away slowly."
It was only a matter of seconds before they would be attacked.
"Jody, I need you to put the car in reverse and back away very slowly. Jody, are you listening?"
She nodded, sniffled, and stopped crying.
"Can you drive us back slowly?"
With painful slowness, Jody put her hand on the gear shift. She started to cry again.
"Jody," Herbert said calmly, "we've really got to go."
She moved the lever just as the front tires exploded. A moment later, gunfire from a semi-automatic began eating into the open door. Herbert rolled back. He opened the rear door, got behind it, and fired a burst from around the side. "Jody!" Herbert screamed. "You gotta reach through the partition, take the guns from the back seat, and shoot! Shoot, Jody, or we're dead! Jody, take the guns and shoot Karen Doring, or she'll goddamn own you!" Apparently that she understood. Jody grabbed the two guns, never even noticing the blood on the back seat where Henri and Eve had died. "Release the safeties," Herbert said. "The little latch is on the..." "Got them," Jody said. Herbert kept an eye on the front line of neo-Nazis as he picked up some soda water bottles from the limo bar and put them in the leather pouch of his chair. As Karen Doring neared, the line grew bolder and one of the men rose. "Bastard!" Jody screamed and shot him. The German dropped. Herbert shook his head as he twisted the bottle caps from two bottles and emptied them. He rolled back a few feet and used his urban skinner to cut a section of gray tubing from the left wheel of his chair. Even Karen Doring wouldn't be able to walk through a wall of fire. Bullets scudded across the hood of the car and ricocheted off. "Jody, push in the cigarette lighter." By this time, Herbert had opened the gas tank and was siphoning fuel into the bottles. He heard the click of the lighter and reached through the passenger's side, pulled some of the stuffing from the bullet-riddled seat, and jammed it in one of the bottles. Then he snatched the lighter, dropped it in the bottle, and threw it. The Molotov cocktail exploded in mid-flight, showering the front of the mob with flaming droplets and shards of glass. Jody looked up with amazement. Her gaze shifted from the fireworks to Herbert. "I'm out of bombs," he said as he pulled himself in. "I suggest we move." Herbert shut the door as best he could as Jody slowly backed the limousine away, slowly pushing Herbert in his chair backward. Ahead, Karen Doring pushed through the crowd, firing after the car. Other guns joined in. "Ow!" Herbert looked to the left as Jody moaned. She slumped toward him. The car slowed, then stopped. He leaned over, saw that she'd been hit in the shoulder. Laying Jody down on the seat, he picked up the second bottle from the floor, jammed in his handkerchief, and lit a match. He leaned around the door and chucked the bottle toward Karen. He turned immediately to Jody. She was holding her shoulder. Herbert pulled his chair into the car, largely so he could have the phone if he needed it. "Jody," he whispered, "can you hear me? I can't step on the gas. Do you think you can do that?" She nodded. "There," he said. "You got it. Now push." The car started back. With his hand on the steering wheel, he guided them along the rough-hewn path. Bullets clanged against the front of the car, but with less force than before. They were shooting through the fire, blindly. The car continued to move backward. Soon the camp was just aglow. Herbert was beginning to think that they might actually get out of the woods alive. And then the car died. Karen Doring watched the retreating car. Manfred grasped her shoulder from behind.
"Karen, we have wounded. Richter needs your help to restore..." "I want those two," she sneered. "Let Richter deal with the bedlam. He wanted to lead. Let him."
Manfred said,
"You know they'll only march into hell for you."
"Into hell?" she screamed. "They scattered like cockroaches when the American turned on them. They shamed me. I shamed myself."
She began to run.
"Karen!"
he yelled. She didn't want to hear anything else. All she knew was that to atone for her role in the debacle, to feel clean again, she had to wash her hands in blood. Hood was looking out the window as Hausen guided the jet to an easy landing. Ballon walked over before the plane had come to a complete stop. Hood ducked through the door. He was followed by Nancy, Stoll, and Hausen. Ballon glanced at them all, but his gaze lingered harshly on Hausen. It snapped back to Hood when he reached the tarmac. "Good evening," Hood said and held out his hand. Ballon led the group to a pair of waiting vans. He turned and said to Hood,
"The search warrant to enter Demain expires at midnight. We've been watching the plant for days by remote cameras, hoping to see something that would justify entering. But so far, there's been nothing."
"There's absolutely no leeway in the warrant?" Hood asked.
"None."
"How long until we reach the factory?"
15 minutes or so."
"We'll help you, Colonel." Ballon thanked him with a small nod. When the car died, Jody shut her eyes.
"I can't move," she panted.
Herbert moved the collar of her blouse aside and gently dabbed at the blood on her wound. The hole wasn't large.
I'm afraid, Jody said suddenly.
She started to whimper.
I was wrong. I'm still afraid.
It's okay. You're asking too much of yourself. Listen, Jody, we're close to where we started, about a mile from the main road. If we can get there, we'll be okay. Sweetie, I've got to fix the wound.
She opened her eyes.
How?
I got to take the bullet out. When I'm done, I'm going to have to cauterize it.
She was suddenly more alert.
You're going to burn me?
I've done it before. What I'm going to do will hurt, but you're hurting now. We've got to stop the pain.
All right, she rasped. Do it.
Herbert placed his left hand over her mouth.
Bite me if you have to, he said as he raised his skinner.
He studied the wound for a moment, steadied the knife, then pushed the blade slowly along the bullet. Jody screamed into his hand. He felt the end and used the blade to lever the shell out. Herbert tucked the knife into his belt and released her. He grabbed the matches.
I need 4 or 5 seconds to seal the wound. Will you give me that?
Her lips and eyes pressed shut. She nodded briskly. Herbert struck a match and used it to set the rest of the matchbook on fire. Once again, pressing his hand to her mouth, Herbert pressed the heads of the matches to the bloody wound. Jody tensed and bit his hand. He knew this pain and knew it would grow worse as the moisture in her skin evaporated. After 5 seconds, he pulled at the matches. They broke from the burned flesh with a slight tug. It was an ugly job, but at least the wound was closed. He removed his hand from her teeth. His palm was bleeding.
Now we'll both have scars to show off. Think you'll be able to walk now?
Jody was sweating.
I'll make it. Did I hurt your hand?
Unless you have rabies, I'll be fine.
Jody moved tentatively as she came around the car. She was more confident with each step and seemed her old self by the time she reached him. She struggled slightly to get the chair out, then held it open for him. Pressing his hands on the car seat, he hopped in.
Let's go, he said. Due east, to the left.
That's not the way I came.
I know, Herbert replied. Just do it.
She started pushing. Far behind them, they heard crunching.
We're never going to make it,
Jody said.
We are, Herbert said, as long as you keep going in this direction.
Jody leaned into the chair and they moved slowly through the dark. And as they did, Herbert told the young woman one thing more he needed her to do. Leaving the vans behind, Ballon, Hood, Stoll, Hausen, and Nancy crossed the Tarn River by foot across a high brick bridge. Streetlights provided them enough light to see. Upon reaching the former Bastide, now Dominique's factory, they sat beside a thicket on the narrow stretch of grass which sloped toward the river. Stoll entrusted his computer to Nancy while he unpacked the T-Bird. He pointed the device at the front of the building and used a button on the imager to activate the laser line scanner. When the machine stopped, Stoll tore off the paper and handed it to Ballon.
What is this? Ballon asked. It looks like a swimming pool.
Stoll looked at the image.
It's a picture of the wall, which is a lot thicker than we thought. Or there's something on the other side.
He looked at the 5-story tall edifice. There were windows, but he was sure there would be radio-reflective materials on the other side. Everyone was silent for a moment. Then Stoll clapped his hands.
I know how to do it. I know how to get that bastard.
Ballon crouched beside him.
How?
The others moved around them as Stoll unwrapped the cables for his portable computer. He attached the machine to the T-Bird.
The programmers work like painters, like we saw in Mr. Hausen's office. They take stuff from the landscape around them and use it in the games. It's dark now, but if I take terahertz pictures of the trees and the hills and everything else, the chemical compounds appear as visual data. If we feed those into the computer,
you can run a video comparison program to see if any of the images match up to the hate game, Nancy said. Matt, that's brilliant.
As Stoll worked, Hood watched, confused but trusting his associate. And as he stood there, his phone beeped. He stepped toward the river to answer. Yes?
Paul?
It's McCaskey. I have a full report, but here's the gist. Maximilian Hausen, father of Richard, worked for Pierre Dupré from 1966 to 1979. His title was senior pilot. You said 1966? I did. That was before Richard Hausen and Gérard Dupré went to school together, in which case it was not likely that they met at the Sorbonne, as Hausen had said. They almost certainly knew each other before that. What bothered Hood was not so much when they met, but whether they were still in contact now, not as enemies, but as allies. There's more, McCaskey said. Apparently, Hausen the Elder was a loyal Nazi who continued to meet in secret with other ex-Nazis after the war. They belonged to the White Wolves, a group which plotted the creation of the Fourth Reich. Hood asked quietly, was Richard a member? There's no evidence one way or the other. Hood was glad to hear that, at least. Thank you. Have a good night. Hood clicked off, then stood for a moment. I hope that's possible, he said under his breath, as he turned and headed back to the others. Jody moved as quickly as her sandbag-heavy legs and aching shoulder would permit, pushing or sometimes pulling the wheelchair. And then she heard the woman's voice shout from behind her,
"Don't move another foot!"
Jody stopped.
"Lift your arms!"
Jody did.
"Take two steps to your left and remain facing away!"
Jody obeyed Karen Doring. She started as the woman put three bullets into the back of the wheelchair. The dead body fell forward.
"God! God!"
Jody gasped. Karen circled the girl. Even in the dark, the terrified young woman could see her angry expression. She also saw the S.A. knife.
"You dared to come to my camp as you did. You dared to challenge me, to insult me?"
Jody said, trembling.
You would have done the same.
"You are not me," Karen said. "You've paid no dues."
Suddenly, three shots flashed in the trees. Karen dropped to her knees, blood oozing from the wounds. Herbert dropped his gun to the ground, then lowered himself from the branch. He hung there from his powerful arms.
"Right about now, I'll bet she's glad she's not you, Karen."
Jody kicked away the body of the dead policeman they'd placed in the wheelchair. Then she ran over to Herbert. He dropped into the seat. Jody leaned against the tree.
"You had to do it, and you did it like a pro," Herbert said. "I'm proud of you."
Herbert put the gun in his leather pouch.
"Let's get the hell..."
Before he could finish, a hulking figure screamed and charged at him from the dark. His knife raised high, the enraged Manfred Piper brought the knife down hard toward Herbert's back. After putting the phone back in his jacket, Hood made his way back up the grassy slope. Stoll was asking Ballon,
"What's the word for anal?"
"Fidèle is retentive."
"Our boy is certainly fidèle. The first game came on promptly at 10, just as they've been hinting at all day during the samples they were showing. I saved it on the hard drive. The T-Bird should have a complete sweep of a landscape pictured in about 10 minutes.
"And then?" Hood asked.
"I have to start playing the game and get to different screens, different landscapes. I'm writing a small modification to the matchbook program so it can read images from the T-Bird. If I don't screw up too much, the background images will keep scrolling along. I'll get a ping when there's a match."
Nancy had walked over while he was speaking.
"I'll help you, Matt. I'm pretty good at these."
Hood regarded them for a moment. The way she touched Matt made him jealous, and the way he was feeling filled him with disgust.
"Herr Hausen," Hood said, "I'd like to talk to you."
"Of course."
"That call I just had, it was from Op Center. There's no delicate way to ask this, so I'll ask it directly. Why didn't you tell us your father worked for Dupré?"
Hausen waited a long time before answering.
"It's true. And it was one of the things Gérard and I argued about that night in Paris."
"Your father worked for this monster?" Colonel Ballon said.
"Where is your father now?"
"He died 2 years ago, Hausen composed himself. "He believed in Hitler and the goals of the Reich.
When I was 11, my father and two of his friends attacked a rabbi's son on his way home from synagogue. Afterwards, my mother sent me to a boarding school in Berlin. I didn't see my father until years later, after Gerard befriended me at the Sorbonne. Are you trying to tell me that Gerard went to the Sorbonne just to become your friend and bring you back? Hood asked. You must understand. I was a force to be reckoned with from an early age. What my father had done revolted me. I can still hear him calling me to join them. While I was in Berlin, I formed an anti-Nazi group. I was never insincere about my convictions. He glared at Ballon. Never! Do you understand? I saw my father twice after the night he attacked the Jewish boy. Once was at the Dupre estate when Gerard and I fled there. He asked me to join them and said it was the only way I could save myself. He called me a traitor when I refused. The second time was the night my father died. With his dying breath, he called me a traitor again. Hood felt the same way he did on the jet. He wanted to believe in this man's sincerity. But there were lives at risk. Hood took the phone from his pocket and punched a number. Darrell, I want to know when Maximilian Hausen died. Hold on. Hood regarded Hausen. I'm sorry, Hood said, but I owe this to Matt and all the other people in this operation. I would do the same, said Hausen. Paul, Hausen the Elder died 2 years ago next month. Thanks, Hood said. Thanks very much. He hung up. Again, Herr Hausen, I'm sorry. Again, Mr. Hood, there's no need to... Paul! Hood and Hausen looked at Stoll. Ballon was already running over. What have you got? Hood asked. Bupkis. I mean, however I poke and prod it, my machine isn't fast enough to do an analysis before 2010. I was about to call Op Center for help when Nancy found something better. She rose and said to Ballon, in other Demain games, you can skip to the next level by pausing the game and pushing the arrows on the keypad in a certain sequence. And? And we're already on level 2 of this game without having played level 1. Would Dominique really have been stupid enough to put the same cheat codes in one of these games? Hood asked. That's just it, Nancy said. It's already in the program. It has to be removed, not put in. Somewhere along the line, somebody forgot to delete it. Ballon was standing very tall and looking toward the factory. How about it? Hood asked the colonel. Is that good enough for you? Ballon snatched the radio from his belt. He looked at Matt. Did you save the game on your computer? The jump from level 1 to level 2 has been copied and stored. Ballon turned on his radio and put it to his mouth. Sergeant Sainte-Marie, allons! Manfred attacked with his knife, stabbing down toward Bob Herbert in his wheelchair. The blade tore audibly through the leather of the back as Jody screamed at the German to stop. Manfred stabbed again, snarling ferociously. Then again. Then there was a loud pop, and he stopped stabbing. He reached for his throat. There was a hole in his flesh, a hole put there by a bullet fired by Jody from Karin's gun. The knife fell from Manfred's hand, and then Manfred fell away from the wheelchair. He twitched for a moment, and then was still. Herbert turned and looked at the young woman.
Oh, God, she said. Oh, God, I killed someone.
No, you saved someone's life. Mine. You had to, just like other people have had to kill in wars. You hear me, Jody? You didn't do anything wrong. Nothing. Jody stood there sobbing. Then she looked at Herbert as though she were noticing him for the first time.
You're not hurt. How did he miss?
I never go anywhere without my Kevlar lining. Multi-layered bulletproofing in the back and seat. I got the idea from the president. The chair in the Oval Office is lined with it, too. Jody didn't seem to hear. Herbert rolled to her side. He took her hand and gave it a gentle tug. You've been through a lot, Jody, but you're almost at the finish line. The home stretch from here to the Autobahn is a little over a mile. All we have to do... Herbert stopped speaking. He heard footsteps in the distance.
Shit, you've got to get out of here. They're coming. Probably to check on the others.
He pushed her.
Go. No, I won't go alone.
Honey, this kind of stuff is what I'm paid to do. Think about your parents.
No,
she yelled. I'm not going alone.
Herbert realized that there was no point arguing with her. All right, we'll go together. Herbert told Jody to retrieve the gun he'd used up in the tree. While she did, he wheeled over to Karin's body and picked up her gun and the SA dagger. Then he went over to Manfred's body and took the German's knife. Over a half century before, a black man, Jesse Owens, had embarrassed Hitler by outracing his Aryan athletes in the Olympics. Now, if a man in a wheelchair managed to escape these tough guys, it could very well end the myth of the Nazi Superman. Certainly among this group. Hood didn't know what to expect as they marched toward the fortress, which had become a factory. As his own small group crossed the ancient walkway behind Ballon and his men, he wondered how many besieging armies had come this way over the centuries. There was very little discussion of what they would do once they got inside. Ballon said that his intention had always been to find evidence tying Dominique to the new Jacobins, then arrest him. His men had been trained to do that. However, Hausen and Hood had persuaded him to let Matt and Nancy take a look in the computers to see what they could find there. Lists of new Jacobin members, or maybe more evidence linking Demain to the hate games. Either one would help bring Dominique down. An iron gate had been added to the perimeter of the Bastide. There was a large red brick booth behind the gate. As the group approached, two men emerged, a guard and a man in a business suit. As he reached the gate, Ballon introduced himself, withdrew a document from his breast pocket, and said, "This is a search warrant." The man in the suit said, "I am Monsieur Vaudran of the law firm Vaudran, Vaudran and Boinard. We represent Demain. You realize what you're doing, I hope. Careers have been ruined by lesser mistakes." "There's only one career at risk," Ballon said. He looked directly at the attorney. "No, two." The guard punched a code into a panel in the booth. Ballon marshaled his men at the gate. They marched up to a golden door. As soon as Ballon's men were inside, they were told to watch the exits and make sure no one left. Ballon and his party continued into the factory. When they reached the end of the long hallway corridor, the colonel said softly, "This way." Ignoring the eyes of other guards who had obviously been advised to let them pass, the quintet walked through a short passageway to the programming rooms of the Demain factory. The former dining hall had been turned into something which resembled the National Reconnaissance Office, with at least 36 computer terminals. The only difference was that there were no people. Dominique wasn't taking any chances. The warrant was due to expire in just over an hour. If no one were there to answer questions, it had to slow them down. "This is some playroom," Stoll said. Ballon said to him, "Start playing." Stoll looked at Hood. Hood nodded silently. Stoll took a breath and looked at Nancy.
"Got a preference?"
"It doesn't really matter. They're all hooked to the same master computer." Nodding, Stoll sat down at the nearest monitor, jacked his portable computer into the back of the console, and powered up. He slipped a diskette into his B drive and booted it.
"I always carry the Bulldozer program I wrote. Bulldozer rolls in and searches for menus. Once I get those, I'm in. And while we look at the data here, I'll be dumping everything into OpCenter's computers."
Ballon squeezed Stoll's shoulder, shook his head, and put a finger to his lips. Stoll drove his palm into his forehead.
"Sorry. Loose lips sink ships."
Ballon nodded.
Hausen said, "Colonel, what are we going to do about Dominique?"
"We wait."
"For what?"
Ballon moved close to the German's ear and whispered,
"For Dominique to get nervous. He is certainly observing us. Hopefully, we'll find something in the computer."
"And if we don't?"
"If he fears that you may finally reveal secrets about his past, the temptation will be great not to let you walk out that door. I've ordered my men to stand back. Once he moves, I'll get all of you out and bring this place down."
Hood just stood beside Matt, silently watching with a mixture of fear and pride as the fate of the world was decided by a perspiring young man at a computer keyboard. When data began coming into Eddie Medina's computer from Matt Stoll in France, the young man notified General Rogers. Then he, too, watched the feed with Daryl McCaskey. First up was a note from Stoll. "Eddie, my Bulldozer program cracked Demain files. I'm going to download everything."
Following the note were photographs of people who served as models for characters in the games. Then the horrible game images began to appear. Suddenly, there was another note from Stoll. Ed, I must have set off an alarm of some kind. People running all around. Colonel Ballon has got his hand full of gun. I'm supposed to get down. Bye. The images continued to come in for a few moments longer, but Rogers wasn't watching them. He had switched to an alternate computer line, and within seconds had been patched through to the cockpit of the V-22 Osprey.
Get away from that keyboard!
Using his left hand, Colonel Ballon pushed Matt Stoll to the floor, and then pressed a button on his radio as the gunman entered. In his right hand was his own weapon, the only one among the five of them. Squatting on the floor beside the others, Hood counted 17 men, passing by the door and taking up positions along the corridor wall. In the quick glimpse he'd had of the gunman, Hood made the new Jacobins out to be a ragtag bunch. I guess these guys are the kind of evidence you were looking for, huh? Stoll said anxiously.
Levez!
One of the men shouted.
He wants us to get up, Ballon whispered. If we do, they may shoot us. I've signaled my men. They will be moving toward us. We'll make the enemy come to us. We're prepared for this.
Hausen said, I'm going to give these animals a chance to shoot. Let's see what they're made of. With that, he stood.
Herr Hausen!
Ballon hissed. The German ignored him. Nothing happened for a long moment. Finally, one of the new Jacobins said,
Allons donc!
He wants Hausen to leave, Ballon told Hood.
When Hausen was through the door, his footsteps stopped. You've dealt with these terrorists, Hood said. What do they do in situations like this?
They beat up or murder people in every situation, Ballon said. But until they get our weapons, they won't.
Then we should get Nancy and Matt out of here. Maybe they can get away.
It's probably worth a try. The danger is that they may use you as hostages, shoot you one by one until I come out. If that happens, I'll signal my men by radio. They're trained for situations like that.
But there are still no guarantees, Hood said. No, Ballon agreed. There are no guarantees.
But if that happens, they'll have to put each hostage in the doorway so I can see. And if I can see, I can shoot. And if I shoot, whoever is holding the hostage will go down. Then you had all better run. All right. I want you all to get up and walk slowly toward the door.
The three were quiet until they hesitantly walked through the doorway. Hood saw Hausen facing a brick wall. One of the men was pointing a pistol against the base of his skull.
Oh, shit, Stoll said as he entered the small, dark corridor.
The three Americans were grabbed by two men each and pushed against the wall. The new Jacobin leader studied them for a moment, and then turned back to the doorway. He shouted for the last man to come out. Ballon yelled back in French,
When you let the others go, I'll come out.
No,
said the new Jacobin.
You come out first.
Ballon didn't answer this time. A gunshot popped from somewhere in the darkness toward the door which led to the main corridor. It took a moment of searching before Hood could see that with all the shouting and shuffling, no one had heard Ballon's men remove the ornate knob from the door. They had a clear shot at everyone in this corridor. The man holding Hausen had fallen. Hausen opened the door and disappeared. Hood didn't move. Perspiration trickled down his armpits. He promised himself that if he survived this, he'd not only hug each member of his family for a good long time, but also Mike Rogers. The man had spent his life surviving situations like these. Hood's respect for him suddenly grew very, very deep. As he was thinking, his hands began to vibrate. No, Hood thought. Not just my hands. The old bricks themselves were beginning to tremble. Then the sky outside the barred windows brightened. The air itself seemed to rattle. And the new Jacobin leader shouted for his men to finish the job and leave. The footsteps were gaining on them. But as Herbert wheeled himself through the woods, he wasn't thinking about them. He wasn't thinking about anything except the key to survival, to victory.
What the hell was that name? I can't remember.
He would. He had to. And then it finally came back to him. A name Richter had spoken with such venom during his campfire speech.
Jody, push me. We're going to get out of this, but we'll need time.
Jody put her tired back and wounded shoulder into the effort. Herbert reached for a weapon. His cellular phone.
The call was put through to Rogers as he was waiting for an update from Colonel August. Rogers switched on the speakerphone so Darrell and Press Officer Ann Ferris could hear.
I'm in the middle of a dark forest somewhere between Wunstorf and a lake, Herbert said. The good news is, I've got Jody Thompson.
Rogers sat up straight and triumphantly drove a fist in the air.
That's fabulous. You've done it while Interpol and the FBI are still asking questions. Well, the bad news is we've got a bunch of Nazi wannabes on our butts. You got to find me a phone number.
Rogers leaned toward the keyboard.
Whose number, Bob?
The general typed in Hauptmann Rosenlocker, Hamburg Landespolizei. McCaskey jumped to another phone and called Interpol.
This Rosenlocker is a burr in the fur of the head Nazi, Herbert said, and he may be the only man you can trust. From what I overheard, he's in Hanover, I think.
We'll find him and get him over to you, Rogers said.
Sooner would be better than later, Herbert said.
I read you. Can you stay on the line?
As long as Jody holds out, I can.
Bob, NRO is trying to spot you. Maybe we can keep you moving away from the enemy. Meanwhile, we're still looking for the officer.
There were 10 closed-circuit surveillance cameras in Dominique's office.
The stupidity of these people,
he'd been thinking as he watched them break into his system and find themselves cornered. Even when the French commandos closed in on the new Jacobins in the corridor, Dominique wasn't concerned. He had sent word for other men to surround them. Nothing must go wrong with the downloading of his games. Dominique wasn't concerned about anything until the building began to shake. He switched to external views of the compound as an aircraft began to settle down. The parking lot had cars scattered here and there, so the aircraft was unable to land. As it hovered 15 feet up, the hatch opened. A pair of rope ladders were unwound, and troops climbed down. NATO troops. Dominique's mouth tensed.
What is NATO doing here?
He roared inside. As 20 soldiers fell in on the parking lot, Dominique rang up the pilot of his Long Ranger helicopter.
André, I'm coming down. Ready boldness.
At once, sir.
Dominique clicked off. He stood and looked out at his collection of guillotines. Then he shut down the TV screens and walked briskly from his office toward the elevator. The elevator took him to an underground passage which led to the landing field behind the factory. The Long Ranger helicopter was already warming up.
Let's go,
he said to the pilot as he entered the spacious cabin. He pulled the door shut. The helicopter crossed the river, then it circled back toward the Bastide. Dominique yelled to be heard over the rotor.
André, what are you doing?
The pilot didn't answer. The chopper began to descend.
André? André!
The pilot said, you told me over the phone that you followed all my moves, but you missed one. The one where I came to your pilot and hit the poor fellow with 20 years of anger. Richard Hausen turned and regarded Dominique. The Frenchman felt ice shoot down his back.
I took off to make room for the other craft, Hausen said. Now, you're going back, Gerard. Back 20 years, in fact.
For a moment, Dominique considered an appropriate response. But only for a moment. Losing control of the delicate balance between danger and need, between reason and desire, Dominique threw himself at Hausen with an inarticulate cry. Mike Rogers was studying a map of Germany on the computer when Darrell McCaskey looked over with a thumbs up.
Got him. Hauptmann Rosenlocker's on the line.
Rogers picked up his phone.
Hauptmann Rosenlocker, do you speak English?
Yes. Who is this?
General Mike Rogers in Washington, D.C. Sir, it's about the attack on the movie set, the kidnapping.
Yeah?
He said impatiently.
We've been following clues all day.
We have the girl, Rogers said.
Was?
One of my men found her. They're in the woods near Wunstorf.
There's a rally in those woods, said Rosenlocker. Karen Doring and her group. We believe Felix Richter may have gone there as well. My investigators were looking into it.
Your investigation was compromised, Rogers said.
How do you know that?
They tried to kill my man and the girl. Hauptmann, they've been running for hours, and there isn't time to get help to them. A large group of neo-Nazis is closing in on my man. If we're going to save them, I need you to do something for me.
What?
Rogers told him. The Hauptmann agreed. A minute later, Op Center's communications expert was making the arrangements. The phone beeped in the dark. The man nearest it, young Rolf Murnau, stopped and listened. When he heard the muffled beep a second time, he swung his flashlight to the left. The beam formed a cone of light on top of a body. From the broad shoulders, he could tell it was Manfred Piper. Beyond it lay Karin Doring's body.
Come here, Rolf shouted. My God, come quickly!
Several men and women ran over.
She's dead, a man said from Karin's side.
Damn them! Dead!
The phone rang again and then again. Rolf looked up.
What should I do?
Answer it, Felix Richter said.
Yes, sir.
He reached into Manfred's jacket and removed the phone.
Yeah,
he said tentatively.
This is Hauptmann Karl Rosenlocher. I want to speak to whoever is in command of you animals.
Herr Richter, Hauptmann Karl Rosenlocher wants to speak with the commander.
Even in the dark, Rolf saw Richter stiffen. Jean-Michel Horn arrived as Richter took the phone. Slowly, the German brought it to his mouth.
This is Felix Richter.
You know my voice, said Rosenlocher. I want you to hear this voice.
A moment later, a young woman said in English,
I told you you didn't beat me. You'll never win, any of you.
Richter said,
Child, we will come after you.
Rosenlocher came back on.
No, you won't, Herr Richter. She's safe with me, along with the American who got her out. He called for me to collect them. Now, how do you think the American got to your camp tonight? He's one man in a wheelchair. Or is he? You were infiltrated, Herr Richter. My people are with you now. They helped him.
You're lying, Richter said tensely.
They've been with you all day.
I don't believe you.
Richter threw down the telephone.
Damn his blood!
What is it?
Someone asked. Richter shook a fist.
Hauptmann Rosenlocher says that we have been infiltrated by members of the Hamburg Landespolizei.
He looked around.
Of course he's lying. It's idiotic, insane. But why lie? He has the girl and the American. What does he gain?
He must be lying, said Rolf.
Why? What does he gain? Fear? Dissent? Indecision? Panic?
He roared gutturally.
What does he gain?
Jean-Michel said from behind him,
Time.
Richter spun on him.
What are you talking about?
The Hauptmann gains time.
To what end? He has what he came for.
Does he?
Asked Jean-Michel smoothly.
I don't think the American and the girl have had enough time to reach the Autobahn. Perhaps the cripple had a phone with him and called the Hauptmann.
You did, after all, give a speech in which you named your worst enemy. It isn't difficult to generate a conference call to make it seem as if Rosenlocher, the American, and the girl are all together.
Richter shut his eyes.
You made the kind of mistake a leader cannot afford to make. You told the American how to beat you, provided him with the name of the one man he could trust.
Rolf was in turmoil, buffeted by grief and rage.
I'm going after the Americans, he said. That's what Karin Doring and Manfred Piper would have wanted.
Several others followed wordlessly, then more and more of them joined in. But as Rolf picked his way through the woods, tears rolled down his cheeks. The tears of a little boy whose dreams of a future with Feuer had just turned to ash. 22 NATO troops entered the Demain factory under Colonel Brett August's command. When the massive V-22 Osprey had descended on the compound and the new Jacobin leader had ordered the execution of his captives, gunfire popped not only from where the doorknob had been removed. It also came from a hole which had been cut in the pasteboard of the false ceiling and from a window to which one of the gendarmerie officers had rappelled. It was a perfect triangulation, and it accounted for three of the new Jacobin wounded, the three men who had been ordered to execute Paul Hood, Nancy Bosworth, and Matt Stoll. As soon as the men fell, Hood threw himself atop Nancy, and Matt Stoll dove for the ground. Ballon received his wound as he ran out to cover Matt. The prisoners were ignored in the madness which followed as the new Jacobins scrambled to escape what had become a shooting gallery and get out into the open. They were back within 10 minutes, trying to hold off the attackers. But by that time, Hood and his companions had retreated to a kitchenette, where Nancy cleaned and bandaged Ballon's wound as best she could, and Hood struggled to keep him down. Despite the pain, the colonel was anxious to get back into battle. Two NATO privates were the first ones into the kitchenette. By then, the corridor had been secured, and a medic was summoned to take care of Ballon. Hood, Nancy, and Stoll were evacuated to the Osprey, where August and his French interpreter had set up command headquarters beside the cockpit. Hood was about to ask about Dominique and Hausen when a light appeared in the sky. It was moving east to west. Suddenly, it turned toward them and grew larger, accompanied by the distinctive beating of a helicopter rotor. August looked up. "One of yours?" Hood asked. "No." A gendarmerie officer approached. A man was draped over his shoulder. "Sous-lieutenant," he called to the interpreter. After several moments, the French officer turned to August. "The man is a pilot, sir. He was warming up the helicopter for Monsieur Dominique when a blonde man hit him." The helicopter began to spiral down, then leveled off again. "Hausen," Hood said. August looked questioningly at Hood, and Paul explained. "Hausen is a German politician and a flyer. He hates Dominique, the man behind all this." "Hates him enough to risk his life stealing a chopper?" "More than enough. I think Hausen would take himself out just to get Dominique." The colonel turned to the interpreter. "Are Manigault and Boisard still on the first floor?"
"Still on cleanup, sir."
"Tell him to report back here at once. You're in charge." August looked up at the cockpit and moved his index finger in a circle over his head. The pilot saluted and fired up the vertical engines. "Colonel, what is it?" Hood asked. August ran toward the stairs which led to the cockpit.
"Somebody wants that chopper to land, and somebody else doesn't. If we don't get aboard, it's going to do neither."
The police car raced along the Autobahn at over 100 miles an hour. Behind Rosenlocker's car were cars designated 2 and 3. Each one carried 6 men of his 15-man tactical force. The officer's phone rang.
"Yeah? It's Rogers. We finally got you all on the satellite. Bob and the girl are about 3 kilometers north of you, headed toward the Autobahn. The neo-Nazis were stopped, but now they're moving again. It'll be close as to who reaches them first."
The Hauptmann leaned forward to his driver.
"Go faster," he said softly. "Thank you, General. I'll call back the moment I have something to report."
"Good luck." The night sped by, and then Rosenlocker saw 2 pale figures amidst the dark foliage on the left side of the road. They ducked back quickly.
"That was one arm of Richter's team," the Hauptmann said. "I can smell those bastards at 120 miles an hour. Slow down."
Seconds later, 2 people struggled from the woods, a man in a wheelchair with a young woman behind him.
"Stop,"
Rosenlocker said. The driver touched the brakes and pulled over as Rosenlocker picked up his radio.
"Car 2, you cover the south flank. 3, you pull up and take the north. I'll bring them in."
The 3 cars stopped 20 meters apart on the side of the road. The drivers remained behind the wheels as the police officers emerged. Rosenlocker was the first one over the guardrail. He was less than 30 meters from the edge of the woods where Bob Herbert and Jody Thompson were rushing to outrace their pursuers. Rosenlocker raised the shotgun. He aimed at the area behind the woman where he saw movement.
"Come,"
he called to Herbert. Jody continued to push. She was panting and stumbling, but she wasn't stopping. Rosenlocker watched the others, concentrating his aim on a clutch of young men who had emerged from the woods. Bold men, obviously, willing to sacrifice their lives to make a statement. After a moment, however, he knew that they weren't going to attack. Rosenlocker didn't see Karin or Manfred. Without the head, the body wasn't going to think or act. Herbert and Jody reached his side. As the police officers remained at their posts, the drivers helped Herbert and Jody into the first car. When everyone was safely away from the guardrail, Rosenlocker turned his back on the woods and walked to the car. He half expected to die. He kept his head erect. Cowards were intimidated by men who refused to be, by men who didn't fear. When he reached the car, he walked to the passenger side and quietly instructed his men to get inside. They drove off without incident. Jody fell against Herbert's shoulder. She began crying big, heaving sobs.
My arm hurts. Everything hurts. Everything.
Herbert cradled her head.
We're going to get you taken care of, he said softly. You're going to be okay. You're safe. You performed like a real hero.
She clutched him around the shoulder. Jody's breath and her tears were warm against his neck. He held her even tighter, so proud of her that his own eyes misted over. Rosenlocker said softly,
Are you all right, Herr Herbert?
Yes, Herbert said. Very.
Your friend the general was correct, Rosenlocker said. He told me that all I had to do was buy you a few minutes. Loosen the noose and Bob will slip out.
Sure, Herbert said. Slip right from the gallows into quicksand. Thanks for hauling us out, Hauptmann. You're going to be on my Christmas card list for a long time.
Rosenlocker smiled. He turned around, picked up his car phone, and asked his dispatcher to put him through to General Rogers in Washington. Felix Richter watched the members of his hunting party straggle back.
Where are the Americans? He demanded.
Rolf was among the first people to return.
The police were waiting, he said. There was nothing to do.
Richter screamed.
Is that what Karen Doring would have said? That there was nothing to do?
Karen would have been there doing it, not waiting for us to come back. Karen wasn't a talker.
I never said I was Karen Doring.
No, said Rolf, you're not. And I'm leaving.
Don't let this end, Richter said.
The men moved past him to join those who were still waiting at the camp. Jean-Michel said from behind,
Herr Richter, if you're clever and determined, perhaps you'll get some of them back. But now it is time to go home.
Jean-Michel looked toward the camp and followed the men, leaving Richter alone in the dark. The Long Ranger was nearly 3 miles downriver, moving southeast, with the Osprey closing the gap. August had his team get the hoist ready. When he told them why, Manigault and Boisard jokingly requested that they please be court-martialed and jump right to the execution instead. The end result would be the same. August had outlined the plan when he had first boarded. The pilot would position the Osprey 100 feet above the Long Ranger. Senior Airman Taylor was going to lower Manigault and Boisard straight down, just beyond the horizontal stabilizer to the crosspiece, halfway between the main cabin and the tail assembly. There was enough room behind the main rotor blades to accomplish that. The only real concern they had was a 5 to 8 second period when the airman or the cable above him was directly behind the main rotor. If the Long Ranger slowed or angled up or down during that time, Manigault or the cable could be sliced to pieces. If the chopper moved at all, Manigault, who would go first, was to release the cable immediately, parachute down, and the mission would be aborted. Otherwise, once both men were on the tail boom, they would make their way to the landing skid and enter the cabin. August watched from the open hatch as both men landed uneventfully. But as they started shimmying toward the cabin, the Long Ranger dove. It was a purposeful attempt to get away and left both men dangling. August got on the radio and ordered his pilot to pursue. Then he turned to Taylor.
Lower that thing again, he yelled. I'm going down.
Taylor said, Sir, the wind and the angle are bad for this kind.
Now,
August barked as he slipped on a parachute.
I'm going to hook her to the tail boom.
Sir, we're testing for 2,000 pounds and the chopper is...
I know, but as long as the helicopter rotor is turning, it won't be dead weight. If we have to, we're going to drag this sucker home. Tell the pilot to stay with him no matter what.
August was lowered at an angle to the chopper, and he grabbed the stabilizer. He hooked himself to the boom and then latched the cable around it as well. It slid back, smacked up against the tail fin with a clang, and held there. August had his fish. The Long Ranger suddenly swung off to the east. The cable played out, and the Long Ranger shuddered as it held. August slid to the skid and made his way toward the cabin. Now he saw the pilot look back at him. There was someone between the seats of the flight deck, on the floor, struggling to rise. As the pilot turned away, he began backing the helicopter up. With a flash of terror, August realized he was attempting to use the rotor to cut the cable. If he couldn't get away, he was going to take everybody down. August reached for the cabin door and literally yanked it open. He hurled himself into the passenger compartment. With two strides, he was on the flight deck. Stepping over the man on the floor, August cocked his arm into a tight jiu-jitsu chamber with the elbow waist high, straight back, and punched the pilot in the side of the head. With piston-like speed, he hit him two more times, then pulled him from the seat. August held the control stick steady while he turned to the man on the floor.
Housen, get up. I need you to fly this thing.
Wheezing, Housen flopped into the seat.
I have it.
The colonel angrily threw Dominique into the cabin, then went back to the open door and shouted to Manigault to undo the cable.
You okay up there? He shouted to Housen.
I'll be fine.
Keep it steady until my two men are safely inside. Then we'll head back to the factory.
Bending over Dominique, August plunked him into a chair in the cabin and stood in front of him.
I don't know what you did, but I hope it was bad enough so that they put you away forever.
Dazed and bleeding, Dominique managed to look up at him and smile.
You can stop me, he said through loose teeth, but you can't stop us. Hate is more bankable than gold.
August smirked and punched him again.
There's interest on my account.
The sad thing was, the bastard was right. Hate and hate mongers continued to flourish. He used to fight them. Used to be pretty good at it. Still was, he had to admit. And though it took a while for his brain to catch up to his heart, he knew that when he landed, he had a call to make. The men of the gendarmerie had secured the factory by the time the Osprey returned. When the helicopters landed, Colonel August personally took charge of Dominique. He could barely walk. August immediately placed him in a van with Ballon and four of his men.
Tell Herr Housen he can have the headlines, Ballon told August before they drove away.
Tell him I will write them myself.
August assured him that he would. Housen was in bad shape. He had told August that Dominique had tried at first to strangle him, and each time Housen had rallied to wrest control of the helicopter, Dominique had kicked or beaten him again. As soon as the helicopter landed, Housen slumped over the control stick. Hood entered the Long Ranger so he could be with the deputy foreign minister until he was evacuated by the medics. Housen looked over and smiled faintly.
We got him.
You got him.
I was willing to die if I could take him with me. I didn't care about anything else. I'm sorry.
No need to apologize. It all worked out.
A stretcher was brought over and Housen was carried from the Long Ranger. Hood walked out behind them.
Paul,
Housen shouted as he was lifted down the steps.
I'm here.
Paul, this is not finished. Do you understand?
I know. We'll get that regional center going. Take the initiative. Now don't talk.
In Washington,
Housen said as he was placed in the ambulance. He smiled weakly.
Next time we meet, in Washington.
Quieter.
Hood smiled back at him and squeezed his hand before they shut the door.
Maybe we ought to invite him to a budget hearing, Matt Stoll said from behind him. This'll seem like a day at the beach.
Hood turned.
You were a real hero tonight, Matt.
Thanks.
Oh, it was nothing, Chief. So I'm just going to tiptoe away and have a nervous breakdown.
Stoll left. Nancy was standing in the shadows. Hood walked over and took her hands in his.
I think this is the latest we've ever been out.
She laughed once. Tears rolled from her eyes.
We were old fogies back then.
She was staring into his eyes with love and longing. She did not intend to make this easy.
There are going to be inquiries, a lot of commissions and court dates. I would like to get you an attorney.
Okay. Thanks.
I'm sure someone will pick up Dumas' assets when this is all cleared up. My staff has muscle in all kinds of places. I'll make sure you're involved. Until then, Matt will find things for you to do.
My savior,
she said dryly.
But I can't give you what you want. Not without taking from someone else, someone I love. I've spent most of my adult life with Sharon. We're intertwined in ways that are very special to me.
For better or worse, richer or poorer,
Nancy said bitterly. That, or even just showing up at the movies. Nancy's mouth turned down. She blinked several times. Ouch, she said. Direct hit. Hood was sorry to have hurt her, but at least he'd found the strength to say what needed to be said. It felt bad, but it felt right. Sorry, he said. Nancy took a deep breath. Not as sorry as I am about everything. Even though this didn't work out the way I wanted, it was good to see you again. And I'm glad you're happy. I truly am. She started to walk away. Hood watched her go, his own eyes dampening. And when she had disappeared into the crowd of police and medics, he smiled sadly. The date, at last, had been kept. Hood, Stoll, and Herbert were welcomed back to Op Center with a small party in the tank, the high-security conference room. The bruised but unbowed Herbert was touched. Stoll lapped it all up. Hood was embarrassed. When prompted to speak, Hood perched himself on the corner of the conference table and said, "All we did was what people like General Rogers and our Stryker personnel do all the time. Run amok abroad," Lowell Coffey, the attorney, suggested, "and make the diplomats earn their pay?" "No," Stoll countered. "Fight for truth, justice, and the American way." Hood quieted the 20 people gathered in the room. "Speaking of which, Mike, you want to make the announcement?" Rogers shook his head and extended his hand toward Hood. Over the weekend, General Rogers finalized plans for Colonel Brett A. August to take command of Stryker. There was applause and upthrust thumbs. Hood said, "The evidence Matt dug up on Demain computers is safe with French prosecutors. Representatives of the U.S. and Germany will be on hand to make sure that Dominique doesn't wriggle away. We didn't put an end to hate, but we did put the hate mongers on notice. At 10 o'clock, I'm meeting with Senator Barbara Fox." There were scattered boos. Hood held up his hands. "I promise you that she won't leave here without rescinding the budget cuts she's threatened. I don't want to keep Senator Fox waiting. I want to thank everyone for this welcome home, and I especially want to thank General Rogers for the support he gave us overseas." Hood left, followed by respectful applause and a few cheers. On the way out, he patted Rogers' shoulder and asked him to join him. They left the tank together. "Is there anything we can do to make Colonel August feel welcome?" Hood asked as they walked back toward his office. "Only one thing I can think of. I'm going to head into D.C. at lunchtime to see if I can find a model of Ravel's Messerschmitt BF-109. We used to build kits as kids, and that was a big one we missed." "Expense accounted," Hood said. Rogers shook his head. "This one's on me. I owe it to Brett." With Rogers' good wishes following him down the hall, he hurried to meet Senator Fox at the elevator. The woman arrived with her two assistants and a sly expression. "Good morning, Paul," the senator said. "Have a restful weekend?" "When my wife wasn't yelling at me for nearly getting killed, yes." "Good." They began walking down the hall. "As for me, I was trying to figure out how I'm going to lop off heads working for the man who just saved the free world. Did you plan that, Paul? Just to make my life difficult?" "I can't sneak anything past you, can I?" The group reached Hood's office. They stopped outside. "Well, I'm still determined to make cuts, Paul. I owe that to the taxpayer." Hood said, "We should talk about this in my office, but we should really talk about it alone. There's something I want to tell you." "I have no secrets from my associates." "I understand that. Still, I'd like to have a moment or two alone with you." Senator Fox said, without looking at her aides, "Would you mind waiting here? I'll be right back." After Senator Fox stepped inside, Hood shut the door. "Have a seat."
"I'll stand, thank you."
He picked up a manila envelope from the desk. He held it toward her, but didn't let go. "This was delivered over the weekend via the German diplomatic pouch. It's from Deputy Foreign Minister Hausen. Years ago, Gerard Dominique and Richard Hausen were students together in Paris. They were out one night. They'd been drinking." Fox's naturally ruddy cheeks lost some of their color. Her dark eyes fell to the package. She moved her thumbs from side to side, trying to feel what was inside. "Photographs," she said. Hood came closer. He said gently, Senator, please sit down. She shook her head and put a hand into the envelope. She selected a photograph without looking. She looked at it. The color snapshot showed a girl standing on top of the Eiffel Tower, a hazy Paris spread behind her.
Lucy.
The senator's voice was choked, barely audible. She put it back and then hugged the envelope to her breast.
What happened, Paul?
Hood watched as tears filled her eyes. Dominique attacked the girls. Hausen tried to stop him. When they left, Hausen grabbed his things. He accidentally picked up their camera in the dark. He kept it, not sure what to do until now. Hood wanted to put his arms around her. Instead, he just watched her, aware of the inadequacy of any words or gestures he might offer. Finally, the senator took a cleansing breath, then returned the envelope to Hood.
Would you mind keeping these for a time? After 20 years, you've given me... Well, it's a buzzword of the 90s, but you've given me closure. I'm just not ready yet to deal with the grief again. I suspect there will be a lot of that in Dominique's trial.
I understand, Hood said. The public senator began to return almost at once.
So, you know that now I can't make cutbacks.
Senator, I didn't do this for political favors.
I know. Which is even more of a reason why I have to fight for you. Op Center has proven its worth. And I do believe, Paul, with all my soul, that we have to get behind our worthy people as well as our worthy institutions.
She offered her hand. Hood shook it. Senator Fox showed herself out, ignoring her aide's questioning looks as she marched them toward the elevator. Hood went around the desk and sat down. He put the envelope in a drawer. Then he took his wallet from his jacket pocket, removed the tickets, and tore them in half. He put them in an envelope and tucked them in the drawer. After 20 years, Hood felt that he had closure as well.
Random House Audiobooks presentation. We hope you have enjoyed this program. Look for Tom Clancy's Op Center, read by Edward Herman, and Tom Clancy's Op Center Mirror Image, read by J.O. Sanders, both created by Tom Clancy and Steve Pachenik.